Morning, Africa. Today is Monday, March 1st, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the challenge to hold powerful countries accountable for human rights abuses.
It must be our collective duty to ensure that this does not go unanswered. UN mechanisms must respond.
Also ahead, the environmental impacts of a 5,600-kilometer Australian fence.
To restore and conserve these ecosystems, the important role of the dingo needs to be acknowledged.
Plus, we meet members of a South African youth choir. These stories and more are next. Our top story today, U.S. intelligence agencies released a report to Congress Friday concluding that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved an operation in 2018 in Istanbul, Turkey, to capture or kill Saudi journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports on reaction to the long-awaited report.
The murder and dismemberment of 59-year-old Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018 shocked the world. His remains have never been found. On Friday, U.S. intelligence agencies declassified a report to Congress, assessing that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the heir to the throne, approved the murder. The U.S. Treasury also imposed sanctions on some of those Saudi officials directly involved in the murder and announced a new Khashoggi ban of visa restrictions on any individual persecuting journalists and dissidents overseas on behalf of a foreign government, starting with 76 Saudis. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it matters that the Biden administration made the report public. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
This is a report that, in a sense, is not fresh off the printing press. It's been there. We released it.
The Trump administration ignored repeated bipartisan attempts by Congress to require the White House to make a determination of all those responsible for the extrajudicial killing and report to Congress on whether sanctions would be applied. In a tweet, the Saudi government strongly rejected the conclusions of the report, saying those responsible for the abhorrent crime have already faced justice. 8 men were convicted in a trial last September that international observers called a farce. Human rights advocates welcomed the release of the report, but said they would like to see the Crown Prince himself held accountable. Philippe Nassif of Amnesty International USA.
I think it sends a huge important signal. I think that the next big, maybe even more important signal is how the international community reacts. I think now we need to see, will the United States pursue a more vigorous method of accountability for the murder of Khashoggi?
Asked about accountability for the Crown Prince, Blinken said the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia is bigger than any one person. He said the release of the report shines a bright light on what happened and hopes the new Khashoggi ban will protect other journalists, dissidents, and their families so that Jamal Khashoggi did not die completely in vain. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
Cracks are emerging in the firewall that until now has protected some of the world's most powerful nations from being scrutinized and called to account for gross violations by the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The executive director of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, called them the untouchables.
And by that, I mean governments that have managed to avoid any real critical scrutiny in the form of a resolution by the council. And the foremost untouchables that I have in mind are China, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Russia.
Addressing the untouchables, Roth said, is not only the biggest challenge facing the council, but is critical to its credibility. He said efforts are underway to draft critical statements on Egypt and Saudi Arabia. He added pressure is growing on Russia because of its alleged poisoning of opposition activist Alexei Navalny. However, of greatest interest, he says, are emerging signs that China may no longer be untouchable.
You know, it has been seen as politically impossible to address the worsening repression in Xinjiang, the ongoing repression in Tibet, the crushing of Hong Kong's freedoms. It was seen as just, you know, impossible to get past China's enormous diplomatic and economic efforts to prevent that kind of critical scrutiny. But the times are changing.
International criticism of China's alleged internment of at least 1 million Uyghur Muslims in so-called vocational education camps hit new heights during the council session's high-level segment last week. In a hard-hitting statement, British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab called the situation in Xinjiang beyond the pale.
The reported abuses, which include torture, forced labor, and forced sterilization of women, are extreme and they are extensive. They're taking place on an industrial scale. It must be our collective duty to ensure that this does not go unanswered. UN mechanisms must respond.
Raab called on the Council to pass a resolution allowing urgent and unfettered access to Xinjiang by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights or another independent fact-finding expert. Raab also condemned the systematic violation of rights in Hong Kong and restrictions in Tibet. His denunciations of China's repressive actions were supported by German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas.
Our commitment to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights also leaves no room for the arbitrary detention of ethnic minorities like the Uyghurs in Xinjiang or China's crackdown on civil liberties in Hong Kong.
China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi hit back hard on his critics. He told them to stop meddling in his country's affairs and to stop using human rights as a pretext to interfere in other countries' internal matters. He spoke through an interpreter.
There has never been so-called genocide, forced labor, or religious oppression in Xinjiang. Such inflammatory accusations are fabricated out of ignorance and prejudice. They're simply malicious and politically driven hypes and couldn't be further from the truth.
Wang Yi said the door to Xinjiang was always open and he invited the High Commissioner for Human Rights to visit. During a regular update to the Council Friday on the global human rights situation, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet stressed the importance of such a visit.
In the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, information that is in the public domain indicates the need for independent and comprehensive assessment of the human rights situation. My office continues to assess the alleged patterns of human rights violations, including reports of arbitrary detention, ill treatment and sexual violence in institutions, coercive labor practices and erosion of social and cultural rights.
Bachelet said she was confident a mutually agreeable arrangement would be worked out for her to visit China. To date, efforts to arrange a visit to the region, which began before she took office in September 2018, have failed to materialize. Discussions between Bachelet's office and Chinese authorities are continuing. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
10 people were arrested in Barcelona on Saturday for assaulting police officers in fresh unrest over the jailing of a rapper for glorifying terrorism and insulting royalty in his songs. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Fresh protests in Barcelona over the jailing of a Spanish rapper turned violent on Sunday, with 10 people arrested for assaulting the cops by nightfall. Trash cans were set on fire, broken glass covered the sidewalks, and police lines formed around crowds. Demonstrations began earlier this month after rapper Pablo Hasél was arrested and taken to start his 9-month jail sentence. Known for being anti-establishment, Hasél was convicted in 2018 for breaking free speech laws, glorifying terrorism, and insulting royalty. In tweets and lyrics, he called Spain's former king a mafia boss, likened Spanish judges to Nazis, and referenced a Basque separatist group, ETA. On Saturday, some 2,000 people in masks and holding banners marched through Barcelona, calling for his release. Police put up barricades downtown as businesses and a police van went up in flames. Pressure now mounts on Spain's government to uphold its recent promise to relax free speech laws.
Thanks to Brian Wood of Reuters for that report. More than 20 million people across the United Kingdom have now received a COVID-19 shot. That's according to Britain's Health Minister Matt Hancock. Reuters' Emma McCarthy reports.
A magnificent achievement for the country. That's how British Health Secretary Matt Hancock described the UK's vaccination effort on Twitter Sunday, after more than 20 million people across the UK received a COVID-19 vaccine. Britain has rolled out Europe's fastest COVID-19 vaccination program, raising the prospect of a lifting of its current lockdown restrictions between now and the end of June. The country also reported a further 6,035 cases within the previous 24 hours and 144 more deaths within 28 days of a positive test. The latest figures meant cases over the past 7 days were down 21.2% compared with the previous 7-day period, and deaths were down 33.5%. Officials advising the government said on Friday that certain occupations will not jump to the head of the queue in the second phase of Britain's COVID-19 vaccination rollout, with people instead prioritised by age.
That was Reuters' Emma McCarthy. This is VOA. The United Nations says that 18 people were killed Sunday when Myanmar police fired on anti-coup protesters around the country. It's the worst violence since the military seized power on February 1st. The UN Human Rights Office says police and military forces fired on peaceful demonstrations. The state-run Global New Light of Myanmar says, quote, severe action will be inevitably taken against riotous protesters, end quote. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling on member states to do more on the situation in Myanmar. Meanwhile, the Foreign Correspondents Club of Myanmar says police have arrested an Associated Press photographer while he was working in the commercial capital, Yangon. In Chad, at least two people were killed after security forces went to arrest opposition candidate Yaya Dillo at his home on Sunday morning. Dillo, who plans to run against President Idriss Deby in a presidential election in April, told Reuters he was attacked at home by members of the presidential guard. He said five family members were killed, including his mother. A government statement says security forces went to Dillo's home to arrest him, but were met with armed resistance. According to that statement, two people were killed and five injured, including three policemen, in the ensuing fight. And the Palestinian Authority shut down most schools in the West Bank Sunday to try to stop a sharp rise in coronavirus variant infections. Officials said intensive care units for COVID-19 patients have reached 95% occupancy in the territory. Meanwhile, Israel approved plans Sunday to offer COVID-19 vaccines to 130,000 Palestinians who work in Israel or in Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. Israel has vaccinated more than a third of its own population, but has given only about 2,000 vaccine doses to the Palestinian Authority amid controversy over who is responsible for sending doses to the Palestinians.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using the Hubble Space Telescope say they found that a comet-like object has temporarily nestled itself among a grouping of asteroids called Trojans that share the same solar orbit as Jupiter. The icy object was identified as a Centaur, which are relatively small in size and are normally found in the space between Jupiter and Neptune. They say it's the first time a Centaur has been spotted among a swarm of Trojans. Hubble images revealed that the object, as it moved closer to the Sun, has developed comet-like characteristics, such as a 644,000-kilometer tail, gas jets, and is covered in a coma of gas and dust. The astronomers ran some computer simulations that suggested the object will stay among the Trojans for about 2 years, when Jupiter will kick it back into its journey toward the Sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. New research has revealed that environmental damage caused by Australia's 5,600-kilometer dingo fence is so vast it can be seen from space. Satellite images have documented changes on both sides of one of the world's longest human-made structures. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Dingoes are descended from South Asian wolves. They rarely bark but tend to howl. They're thought to have arrived in Australia with Asian seafarers about 3,500 years ago. A study of the 5,600-kilometre dingo fence in the red sand dunes of the Strzelecki Desert in central Australia has revealed what happens when a key predator is removed. Adrian Fisher is a lecturer in remote sensing at the University of New South Wales.
Using 32 years of satellite images, we saw that the dynamics of the vegetation cover was different on either side of the fence. On the side where dingoes are rare, we found many more kangaroos whose grazing lowered the grass cover across the landscape.
Fisher says that overgrazing damages soil quality, making the ground more vulnerable to erosion. He says dingoes not only keep kangaroo populations in check, they can also limit the ecological damage caused by feral pests.
It's clear that dingoes keep kangaroo numbers low, and where there are dingoes, there are fewer foxes and cats. This means that outside the fence, it's common to find small native mammals like the dusky hopping mouse. Together with the satellite images, this research clearly shows that the removal of the apex predator has had widespread effects on the landscape and its biodiversity. To restore and conserve these ecosystems, the important role of the dingo needs to be acknowledged.
The fence was built in Australia in the early 20th century to help protect sheep. Tearing parts of it down would threaten the livestock industry. But the authors of the university study hope that a balance can be found that restores ecosystems and protects farms. The University of New South Wales study was published in the journal Landscape Ecology. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The U.S. and Africa are separated by an ocean, but ties between the continent and U.S. cities run deep. That's the idea behind a new interactive report called Africa Matters to U.S. Cities. For more on the report, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with its main author, Judd Devermont, who is the director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Here's a clip of their conversation.
You know, when people in Washington, D.C. talk about why Africa matters to the United States, what they really mean is why Africa matters to national security interests, terrorism, piracy, infectious diseases, humanitarian crises. And our view is that this doesn't resonate with most Americans.
You cite a survey conducted by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs that indicates that at the beginning of 2020, only 1% of Americans felt that Africa is the most important region.
And so we decided that we needed to take a different cut of this issue and understanding at the city level how Africa and African diaspora enrich the lives of Americans in ways that they could touch and feel. So we ended up looking at 15 different cities all across America. And in every single one of them, you learn that the African diaspora plays a big part in the cultural lives of a city. And the trade between these cities and the continent can be substantial.
What are some specific examples of how trade with Africa or through Africans have benefited American city dwellers?
If you're based in Atlanta, you know that Coca-Cola has a huge Africa portfolio and that it brings money and revenue and jobs to Atlanta. If you're in Salt Lake City, you know that many Mormons do missions on the continent and have great experiences, and students come to study at Brigham Young. It's about those personal connections that people make. You live in Seattle and you work for the Gates Foundation. You understand how important the philanthropic arm of the city is and how that enriches the city. And African students in 2019 brought $1.7 billion to American economy. And Africans are at the forefront of academic excellence. Brown University hosted Chinua Achebe, the famed Nigerian author, to teach Americans about literature. And in Denver, we feature Nketa Ricks, the first Liberian-American member of the state assembly, and all the work that she is doing for her community. In each of these examples, you can show how Africans are coming to America and enriching our cultural lives and expanding our economies.
Of course, African immigrants of all kinds have often been a boon to America's cities.
Africans are some of the most educated immigrants in America. Whether you are in a red or a blue state, most cities have a proud tradition of welcoming immigrants and welcoming refugees.
That runs a bit contrary to former President Trump's policy, which made work and student visas quite difficult to obtain.
And it was a mean-spirited policy, particularly when it came to blocking African immigrants. But thankfully, we have members of Congress who are committed to this relationship, and we have phenomenal diplomats in embassies who are doing the good work. And now I think all of that's going to come together under President Biden, who within the first 2 weeks of his administration sent a video message to the African unions that has reversed the travel ban and has already talked to President Ramaphosa of South Africa, President Kenyatta. So we've seen a dramatic turnaround.
And just to bring the conversation full circle to the beginning, when we were talking about traditional security concerns, there are some great partnerships between some American states and African nations. Want to say something about those?
In Alabama and in New Mexico, those National Guards have deployed to Djibouti. And then the National Guard in North Carolina has a state partnership program with Botswana. In Albuquerque, Sandia National Laboratory has done partnerships with African governments to teach them and to learn from them about how do you address infectious diseases. So there's a lot of work in all sectors that I think are tributes to the relationship and the potential there.
That was Judd Devermont, director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. South Africa's Ndlovu Youth Choir has been active since 2009, but it really got its wings in 2019 when its popularity soared on America's Got Talent. VOA's Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa, joined two of the leading choristers earlier this week in a virtual conversation to find out more about their latest music video release entitled We Will Rise.
Joining me now from Limpopo Province are two choristers. We have Sandile and Lungelo. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Let's just get your self-introductions. What is your full name? How old are you? And how long have you been with the choir?
Well, I'll start. I know it's ladies first, but I'll start. Yeah, I'm Sandile Majola, and I'm 26 years of age. I've been with the choir since 2009, before it became professional.
I am Lungelo Masango. I've been with the choir since 2015. I think it's been 6 years. Yeah.
All right, so let's watch a little bit of We Will Rise, and then we'll come back and talk about it some more. Okay, now this is a beautiful music video, very inspiring, but it's just one of many videos that you guys have put out. So how is this one different than all of the other visual performances you've done?
This one is different because it came out on a very difficult time, as we are all facing this pandemic right now. And the message that we wanted to send out was that we will rise above whatever that we're facing right now.
What about all the costuming? You've got a clown in there, you have showgirls, you have all kinds of different costumes. What's going on there?
We were displaying the different kind of people in the entertainment industry. So we wanted people to understand that we're talking about the entertainment industry as a whole, not just choir, the people who sing,
yeah,
but who dance too and do theater shows and stuff like
that. Chats, crew members, everyone that everyone has their work on hold during this pandemic and couldn't do what they love.
I read too that when you started Sandile, you had no musical experience or background whatsoever. Is that true?
No musical experience whatsoever. Didn't even know how to play those drums, nothing.
So how did you get into the choir? How did you get into the choir?
I had the voice that I could sing, but it still needed some training, and I still needed a lot of training.
I notice you're performing in an auditorium that has empty seats in the background. At one point in the middle, the curtains open and, you know, it's empty.
It really is empty, and that's the life right now.
Yeah.
How has the choir shaped your lives?
It has shaped our lives in different ways. It has given us all voices. It has hope, dreams. It has given us a space to dream and to feel that if you can dream it, you can be it, you can do it. The stages that we've been, the people that we always look up to, we are now working with them. We are now amongst the greatest people that we've always seen on TV.
What's up next? What are you guys planning? I'm sure you're all waiting for your vaccines to come in there and have an effect. Hopefully 2021 will bring us some relief. Are you already planning for what you're going to do when you can actually have wings again and fly?
Doing shows. We are owing a lot of people a lot of shows. And so this pandemic has just hit us so bad that we had a lot planned, and we're just gonna take it from where we left, and we just cannot wait. We're tired performing for
we're
cameras.
Tired. We're tired of performing for empty chairs and stuff like that. We're not.
Yeah, so we miss people.
We miss people.
We miss exchanging energies. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks to Heather Maxwell, host of VOA's Music Time in Africa, for that report. Well, that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, and our editor, Bill Eagle, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned about the escalating crackdown by the government of President Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. The regime's actions under the so-called foreign agents law forced the recent closure of two bastions of free expression, the Nicaragua chapter of PEN International, a writers' organization, and the Violeta Barrios de Chamorro Foundation, a civil society group. Foundation advisor Cristiana Chamorro called the new law unconstitutional and monstrous. In a virtual news conference, she said, "It is very difficult to continue operating under a law like this, whose objective is to suffocate civil society and independent and free voices that this regime cannot tolerate." The ruling Sandinista National Liberation Front passed the foreign agents law in October and recently declared February 5th as a deadline to register. The law requires people and organizations receiving funds from outside Nicaragua to register as foreign agents with the Interior Ministry and provide an accounting of their income and expenditures to the government, or face fines, imprisonment, and confiscation of their property. These developments further suffocate Nicaraguan civil society and take the country further away from free and fair elections in November, said State Department spokesperson Ned Price in a statement. Ortega is driving Nicaragua toward dictatorship. This will further isolate his regime from the global community. PEN International President Jennifer Clement warned against the legislation when it was first being considered. The trials, persecution, and attacks against journalists and media critical of the Nicaraguan government, she said, prove that the country's authorities act systematically to restrict the right of freedom of expression. Respect for rights must be a priority for the state, said Ms. Clement. We urge Nicaragua's government to stop criminalizing independent voices. The United States is committed to supporting the Nicaraguan people and their demand for democracy. We are focused on empowering civil society and improving respect for human rights, said State Department spokesperson Price. We urge President Ortega to change course now.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.